This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me, I'm really pleased to have Paul Levy. He is the author of, most recently, The Quantum Revelation, A Radical Synthesis of Science and Spirituality. Sting, the musician, said the quantum revelation is mind-blowing. Paul, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here, Tom.
Glad to have you here with us.
Yeah, really.
So quantum physics, you say this is the greatest, the most profound scientific discovery in the history of the human race,
right.
And this is the thing, or a thing, that could save humanity?
Yeah, that's very true. And it's not just my opinion that it's the greatest discovery in all of history in the realm of science. I mean, that's beyond debate. What is up for debate is, what does it mean? Because it's such a radical discovery. And I'm pointing at that it's actually, when you understand what it's showing us about the, you know, who we are and this, you know, what the world, you know, the whole nature of this reality, that it's offering us the solution, you know, in a real way to the world crisis that we're in. And that's what my book is about.
So the key concept within quantum physics that you're hanging this on, is, as I recall, is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle?
That's
when you observe something, you...
Right, that's part of it. It's really the act of observing. So quantum physics didn't come out of a void. It came out of what, you know, the pre-quantum physics, which was the Newtonian point of view, which basically was imagining that this world objectively existed, and
right,
that
and
we...
Totally mechanistic.
Yeah, totally mechanistic, deterministic, and we were just passively observing it, trying to figure it out. Well, quantum physics came in and basically proved that there's no such... that the idea of there being an objective world, that's an illusion. It doesn't even exist. And to even talk about an objective world is total nonsense. And so quantum physics actually discovered that the act of observing this world actually influenced, in the moment, the very world that we observe, that the act of observation, the observer, and the object observed were all interconnected parts of one quantum system.
Yeah. There was a debate about the spiritual nature of reality back in the 18th century, as I recall. Dr. Samuel Johnson said, you know, they got into this debate, and the question was asked to him, how do you refute the idea of an objective physical reality? And he said, I refute it thus, and he kicked a stone and hurt his foot. I mean, how do you react to that?
Right. Well, the thing is that it's not to say that there's nothing out there. What quantum physics is pointing at is that it doesn't exist objectively separate from us in the way that we've been trained to imagine. So this phenomena of the observer effect is the doorway that really opens up what I'm pointing at, that quantum physics is actually offering humanity, because it's pointing at that the act of observation is creative, and that's always the case 24/7, but our species is enacting that unconsciously, and because it's unconscious, then it's actually the way that it'll manifest in our world will not be serving us, will actually be harming us, and that's actually playing out both individually and collectively in the body politic.
So it's like a giant feedback loop.
Yeah, it's an instantaneous feedback loop.
Yeah.
And so the point is that what quantum physics is pointing at, I mean, you know, in a real simple way, is that this reality is it's exactly as if it's a collective shared dream that we're all dreaming up into materialization. But because it's a dream in a certain way, if we hold a particular viewpoint, then this dreamlike reality will instantaneously reflect back that seeming viewpoint as being seemingly objective. So then we have the evidence to prove to ourselves that our perspective is actually correct, that we're seeing what's objective reality. So we become more entrenched in that viewpoint, and it's a feedback loop.
This sounds very esoteric. Can we translate this into kind of a practical reality?
When you're
struggling with Donald Trump as president or whatever.
Right. Well,
From a quantum physics point of view, if
what quantum physics is saying is true, and it's never been proven the slightest bit to have any inaccuracy whatsoever, then from that point of view, what we're experiencing now is a mass shared dream, which is to say that Donald Trump, that we've dreamed him up, all of us collectively have dreamed up
himself included,
Trump, himself included, as a dream character who's embodying a particular quality. Like for me, maybe he's embodying ignorance or just madness or narcissism. But if I'm seeing him as separate, then that, you see, the whole thing about quantum physics is that it's pointing out that there's no separation in this universe, that everything is seamlessly interconnected with everything else. That includes Donald Trump. So he's a dream character. He's a reflection of that part of me. And then as soon as I see that, then all of a sudden I'm not like reacting to him as if he's separate, which then, you know, I become conditioned by my reactions. And actually by having that unconscious, you know, reaction, I'm actually feeding the negative energy in the field.
No, I got it. And, and this is kind of the struggle for people who understand quantum physics and try to translate that into an epistemology, essentially, you know, for lack of better description, a religious system. You know, it's sometimes referred to as a New Age system or something like that.
Right.
That, oh, it's just all a dream. Or Hinduism, actually. I mean, this is 6,000 years old. This is the core of Hinduism, in fact.
Right.
But that it's all a dream. And then, again, we constantly come up against that Samuel Johnson problem. You know, I'm being waterboarded. How do I tell myself this is just a dream? You know, or...
Right. And like I was saying, it's not like that there's... that that's not happening if it's waterboarding or kicking his foot on a stone and there's pain. But the whole point is that our experience is actually not objective in the sense that, you see... what quantum physics has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's nothing objective outside of us, that we're part of the universe that we're observing, and the act of observing actually influences
but
the very universe.
Even that implies that each one of us is a separate consciousness. Isn't our consciousness part of the great consciousness, and isn't the great consciousness really the only thing that exists?
Yeah. So in other words, we're actually these microcosmic fractals, we're interconnected with the macrocosm, so we're not separate from the whole field. So what that means is that when any of us has an expansion of consciousness, that immediately gets deposited in the collective unconscious of our species. And so the idea, like, you know, to what quantum physics is really getting at is that we're actually interconnected with the universe and with each other, that we depend on each other, that we're interdependent. And that cuts through the whole idea of separation. Because if you see there's nothing objective out there, and that's what quantum physics is showing, what happened to the subject? If there's no object to have relationship to, what happens to us as subjects? So it puts into question, who are we? And that's where quantum physics becomes this sort of a path of having to do with, you know, spirit, with spirituality.
Yeah. My wife loves this. We back 40 years ago in San Francisco, there was this guy, Sufi Sam, who was kind of a well-known Sufi master in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he had this theory that when we die, we go into the great goulash pot, you know, mm-hmm, the great soup pot. And we get all chopped up into a million little pieces and just become part of the soup. And every time somebody is born, this was a reincarnation story, which is not what we're talking about here, but just for illustration purposes. When we're born, the great soup maker puts a ladle into the soup and pours it into the new body. And so our obligation as we go through our lives, and this is where I think it kind of meshes with what you're saying, mm-hmm, is to brighten the soup, to lighten the soup, to heal the soup, to help the soup.
Right. Well, you know, what quantum physics is saying, because we're interconnected, any one of us having a moment of expanded awareness or owning our shadow or seeing the dreamlike nature, that expansion of consciousness gets deposited in the non-local field of the universe, and immediately there's more light in the universe when any of us begins to wake up. And not only that, we might be the actual us doing that, us having that moment of expanding consciousness could be the very catalytic sort of moment that will precipitate a global awakening in the entire species. I mean, that's a possibility.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
And if I could say one other thing, too, the thing about quantum physics.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
We're out of time, Paul.
Oh, okay.
Paul Levy, Levy, excuse me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The book is The Quantum Revelation. Paul Levy is the author. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Yeah, totally. Tom, thank you
good
so much.
You
I really appreciate it.
Great. Everyone. And welcome back, Marriott in Littleton, Colorado. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, it's Marriott.
Marriott. So, hey,
Marietta.
What's up? What's on your mind today?
Like Marietta, Georgia, but an A.
Oh, yeah. I used to live there.
Yeah, I am. I have a couple of questions. Well, a question, you know, you mentioned DACA and that the judge, you know, wants something to be done about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also wondering about these 572 children also that are in limbo that may not be eligible to, you know, to be reunited or, you know, with their parents. What does he expect to do with these children? I mean, was he going to give them citizenship then? Well, you know, if they aren't reunited, what's going to happen to these kids?
I don't think they'd even thought it out that far. I really don't. I don't think they'd even thought it out that far. I think that Stephen Miller, this white nationalist racist in the White House who's driving this policy and in all probability came up with this idea, thought, oh, this will be something that'll, you know, get the white people cranked, and this is something that, you know, will be a great little moment for us, and this is something that'll make people feel like, you know, we're fighting, you know, the white people who are concerned about brown people coming from south of the border, make them feel like we're fighting for them. And I don't think that they actually thought about what do we do with these children once we take them away from their parents. I think they just kind of had this thing in their mind that there's this giant foster care system and an adoption system that they'll just kind of merge into and vanish. Which, by the way, is what seems to have happened with several hundred of these kids.
Right. That, you know, the other point I have to it, is it possible to ever recall like Mitch McConnell, can people of Kentucky vote on recalling him for not bringing, you know...
No, they can Mitch McConnell, a United States senator, can be impeached by the House and Senate, or they can be defeated in an election. And it's possible if they, you know, if there was some basis for it, like they had committed some kind of crime or they'd been caught in some really, you know, grody thing, that, that the governor could, in their own state, and the state legislature, and this varies from state to state, depending on how the state constitutions and state laws are constructed, but there may be a mechanism to remove a United States senator there, although I'm not certain of that. But I know that it's happened, but I think it's always happened voluntarily. You know, the kind of Mark Sanford situation, you know, where they go, oops, you know, you busted me, and then, you know, bail out. Makes sense, Marriott?
Right. Okay, well, I appreciate your responses.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Yep, good talking with you. And Jim in Denver. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today? Jim?
Jim, yes.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, I just... go ahead. We've got about 40 seconds here. Quick one, Jim.
Yeah, I disagree. You mentioned about... the semi-automatic pistols should be only legal for military.
And police.
The cops are using them, and that's what's killing all these black kids. They're getting shot 15, 16 times by those semi-automatic
pistols. It really just takes one bullet, maybe two at the most, Jim. If they still had revolvers, they'd still be killing black kids, as they were, as they have been for centuries. I disagree, respectfully.
Yeah. Well, those guns are good enough for Broderick Crawford and Dirty Harry.
There you go. There you go. Well said, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. I appreciate it. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I wanted to just cover a couple of other stories that are in the news that I think are quite consequential and things that we should be paying attention to. You'll recall a week or so ago we had this conversation with Greg Palast about how the guy, Brian Kemp, in Georgia, who is running for governor, was the Secretary of State. And as Secretary of State, well, actually, he is the Secretary of State, I guess. But last year, in 2017 alone, we don't know what he's done this year, in the state of Georgia, he removed the names of 591,548 voters from the voting rolls in Georgia. Just took them off the rolls. And, you know, I've been saying for a long time, I am of the opinion that the redshift that we're experiencing in the United States, that is the difference between what people tell exit pollsters when they leave the polling place and about who they voted for, and what the electronic voting machines say they voted for. You know, for a long time, I thought that most all of this could be accounted for by the machines being hacked. I mean, that was the only thing I could come up with. But now with these huge voter purges, I think that probably the largest percentage of this is actually the voter purge. That people show up to vote and they don't understand, they don't know that a provisional ballot is not counted. So you go in to vote and you say, hi, you know, I'm Tom Hartman, I'm here to vote. And the polling worker looks at you and says, well, I don't see your name here on the ballot or on the, you know, list, on the registered voters list. And so I said, well, geez, what do I do? I mean, here's my voter registration card, here's my ID, here's, you know, everything you want. And they say, well, we'll give you a, hey, George, bring over a provisional ballot, would you? Or bring over a provisional ballot, would you, for Tom here? And so I get this provisional ballot, and I have no idea what provisional means. I think, that's the ballot you give people who aren't registered to vote or who had a glitch. But I still get to vote. Isn't that cool? And so I get this ballot, and I go through, and I mark it all up, and I say, okay, here's my ballot. And they say, thank you very much. You know, put it in the box, and off you go. And I walk out thinking that I voted, when in fact I didn't, because the vast majority of Americans don't know that provisional ballots aren't counted. And so I walk out of the polling place, and there's the exit pollster who is saying, hey, how'd you vote, Tom? And I say, oh, I voted for so-and-so and such-and-such, and they write it all down. And then when the machines are tabulating the votes at the end of the day, my vote doesn't get counted because it's a provisional ballot, and provisional ballots are only counted many days later if I go down to the Secretary of State's office and prove that I am who I am and reinstate me on the rolls and find that provisional ballot. And basically, bottom line is fewer than 1% of them ever actually get counted, period. And so then when the exit polls come out versus the voting numbers, well, in Missouri, for example, there's a 5.4% redshift. 5% of all the Democratic voters in Missouri thought they voted for a Democrat, but their vote didn't get counted. In New Jersey, it's 4.2%. Chris Christie's state. In Utah, it's 2.8%. In Maine, it's 3%. In Ohio, it's 4.5%. And Ohio is the state that went to the Supreme Court and said, we want to continue removing people from the voting rolls. And we've got this system to do it. If they didn't vote in the last election, then we send them a postcard. If they don't send the postcard back, then we remove them from the voting rolls. And so, you know, you've got midterms in there, and so that's the last election, right, that you didn't vote in, and so, you know, you get nailed. And, you know, this is, and who returns postcards, right? I mean, you know, you think, what, is this a scam? Is this some kind of, you know, I mean, we've all gotten this stuff in the mail that looks like official notice, right, from the National Information Clearinghouse Incorporated. But it looks like a government document. And it's like, you know, census information or something like that on the outside. And then you open it up and it's like, when you fill out your census form, will you be sent, you know, or something like, and most of us figure out this is a scam, right? This is some organization that's trying to, or some company basically that's trying to get me to respond. They want to know that I'm here. They want to, so they can sell me something. They can hustle me for something. And so you get a postcard, and the states that don't want you to respond, and particularly if they're selectively mailing these postcards into neighborhoods of, you know, of elderly people, college students, and people of color, and you know, and cities that tend to vote Democratic, like, you know, downtown Portland, regardless of ethnicity. When they do this, some of these states actually go out of their way to make the postcard look like it's junk mail, so that you won't return it. So you get the postcard and you just take one glance at it and go, oh, junk mail. And you just lost your right to vote. Now, I would think, and I'm guessing you would think, this is just absolutely wrong and should be illegal. But the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, the five right-wingers on the Supreme Court just a few months ago said, no, it's just fine, Ohio, go ahead. Knock another couple hundred thousand people off your voting rolls, which Ohio is aggressively doing right now in anticipation of this election. And other states are going, oh, you let Ohio do it? I'm going to do it. The New York Times had a piece by Maggie Astor back in June titled, Seven Ways Alabama Has Made It Harder to Vote. Now, this is not totally unique to Alabama. You'll find this all over the country. But Maggie is writing specifically about what happened in Alabama. Number one, photo ID. within 24 hours of the Supreme Court's ruling. Now, this was not the Ohio ruling. This was the ruling back several years ago that said that the Voting Rights Act, which was signed in 1965, the Voting Rights Act, which said that the states that have historically practiced Jim Crow kind of discrimination, in other words, refusing to let people vote, the states that had literacy tests, the states that had functionally poll taxes, that they could not make a change to their election laws without it being pre-cleared by the federal government. The Supreme Court blew that up. Within 24 hours of the Supreme Court's ruling, she writes, Alabama announced that in 2014 it would start requiring photo ID. That's number one. Number two, driver's license offices are closed in black areas in Alabama. Number three, officials are pushing for proof of citizenship. Number four, dozens of polling places are closed in areas that are black areas, college towns, and in older neighborhoods. Get out the vote group is hamstrung. Voter rolls are purged, and felon reenfranchisement is not publicized.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Make no mistake about it. This is a system that the Republican Party has come up with to make it harder for you to vote, which is, means it's all the more important that we all show up. Here with you, and let's check out a geeky science report here. Maybe? Maybe not? I don't know. I'm not hearing anything. Okay. Take a vacation from exercise. Your body may not thank you. This is in the New York Times today by Gretchen Reynolds. It's a study that was done. This is a pretty shocking study, actually. You know, at the height of summer, she writes, naps on the beach can be alluring, and many of us find ourselves tempted to take prolonged vacations. Okay, in this study, what the volunteers did, in this study, what the volunteers did was they stopped moving around. These were people who, you know, they kept them to 2,000 steps a day or fewer, and they spent 3.5 additional hours each day sitting in an easy chair, right? Three and a half hours a day sitting on a couch or easy chair, pretty much not moving, like watching TV, and walking fewer than 2,000 steps. Now, I'm guessing most Americans walk fewer than 2,000 steps. That's what they had these volunteers doing. And at the end of a two-week period, what they found was, these are people who had been more active than that, what they found was the volunteers almost all had developed what scientists call metabolic derangements. During their 2 weeks of being still, their blood sugar levels had risen, their insulin sensitivity had declined, their cholesterol profiles became less healthy, and they lost muscle mass in their legs while gaining fat around their abdomen in a two-week period of not exercising. That's mind-boggling. Okay, that's our geeky science for the day. Now, let's pick up some of your phone calls here. Noah in Alabama, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Noah, what's on your mind?
I live in Alabama, up in the northwest corner. And you were just talking about the voting in Alabama. It is true, yes, they do require photo ID, but there's nothing wrong with that. The whole fact that that is considered.
And they also closed down the driver's license bureaus in the black parts of town for six months.
No, they have not, because we live right by a black part of town, and they are all open.
Yeah, well, you know, this is pretty solid stuff. I threw the thing away, and I can't. Here it is, right here. No, it's not. Let me get this article back. I'll read you exactly what she said about this. She says, photo ID, dozens of... Here, by November 2016, this was done in 2016, by the way. By November 2016, Alabama had at least 66 fewer polling places than it did in 2013 when the Supreme Court said, Alabama, you could just start messing with people. Because only 18 of Alabama's 67 counties were examined, they said, you know, they're not sure exactly what to derive from this. But for example, Daphne, a city of 26,000 near Mobile, eliminated three of its polling places in 2016, disproportionately affecting one of two districts with a significant number of black voters. A Reuters investigation also found racially disparate closings in the state of Georgia. Nationwide, 3,000 polling places closed between 2012 and 2016. More than 860 of the closings were uniquely in seven states, including Alabama, where some or all counties were subject to federal oversight under the earlier Shelby ruling. So, you know, you may not be able to see it, Noah. You're not going to see people out on the streets, you know, waving their hands and going, "Oh my God, I couldn't vote." Or where did the voting place go? But if you're black in Alabama, I'm pretty sure that you know that this is what's going on. Noah, thanks a lot for the call. Greg in Harlem, New York. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, I just want to tell you, you know, I remember back in 1976. I was a congressional intern, and I was at, you know, college watching, a dormitory watching the 1976 Democratic Convention with Jimmy Carter being nominated. I'll never forget, Barbara Jordan said something very interesting. She said, the great Barbara Jordan, who we miss, mm-hmm. she said, quoting Lincoln, "I would not want to be the slave nor the master." And for those who speak violence and those who speak, well, let's go do this, those words, "I would not want to be the slave nor the master." We cannot become like these right-wing nuts and these idiots.
Right.
We can't become like them, but we're just as bad as them if we become like them.
I agree.
That's all I want to say.
This was the great challenge, Greg, that Native Americans in this country, and there's been several books written about this, but probably the best is Peter Farb's books, Man's Rise to Civilization and the Native Americans of North America, that they confronted Europeans who engaged in genocidal warfare, and there were no Native American communities on North America who engaged in genocidal warfare. They had wars. But the object of the war wasn't to kill everybody on the other side. The object of the war was typically to draw the first blood and then let the guy go. You know, it's called counting coup. And so the Native Americans were like, the Iroquois, they settled their conflicts by playing lacrosse. They invented a game to settle their conflicts. So they're looking at people who are coming in saying, "We're going to kill all you guys." And they're faced with a couple of options. Number one, they can run. Number two, they can just stand there and die. Or number three, they can take up arms and become the people that they're fighting against. And different Native communities chose different of those three options. And it seems that, I'm not sure that we can say any one of those three worked better for them, because they pretty much all got wiped out as a result of the superior technology of Europeans and the willingness of Europeans to commit genocide, which was not a willingness that was broadly available. For example, when the, what was the tribe? There was a tribe in the Northeast that the Americans had, they were British subjects at the time. This was in the 1600s. This was under Bradford, the governor of, or who ultimately became the governor of that state. They enlisted one tribe to help them fight against another tribe, and these were tribes that had been traditional enemies. And when the when the white people came in and burned the village down and shot the women and children, the tribe that had been enlisted to help the white people said, "That's it. We're out of here. We're not going to have anything more to do with this." And I'm sorry, I can't remember the tribes, but there's lots and lots of those stories. And I think that's the same situation we find ourselves in, Greg. And it's a terrible one. Greg, thanks for the call. Well said. I really appreciate it. Really, really well said. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Tom, I wanted to explore some with you about this, the voting. I don't know what it's called when the state sends you a postcard and asks you to verify your address.
It's called caging.
What is that? What's that called? Is that called caging or
something? Yeah, at law, it's called caging.
Okay. I think that there is, this is unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment. I would say that you're not obligated to respond to government in order to protect your rights, your basic rights.
I agree with you. The Supreme Court disagrees with you.
Is there a decision about that?
Yeah, the Ohio decision from 2-3 months ago. This is what Ohio is doing. Ohio's policy was, if you miss one election, they send you a postcard. Originally, it was two elections. They send you a postcard, and if you don't return the postcard, they take you off the voting rolls. And the Supreme Court said, that's fine with us.
The argument I would make would definitely be under the Fifth Amendment. Your Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself, or you don't ever have to respond to government. And this would be, of course, because this has to do with the states, it would require incorporation of the 14th Amendment. But I guess I wasn't aware of that case. We need to recognize that our elections have consequences, because that was what Neil Gorsuch helped Ohio do.
Yes, it was a 5-4 decision. You're absolutely right.
No kidding. Really? No, 5-4. And the Roberts Court... More 5-4 decisions. Actually, most people don't know this, but 50% of the decisions, at least 50% of the SCOTUS decisions, are 9-0. But the Roberts Court has more 5-4 decisions, I think, than any other court. And as all conservative courts, I know conservatives refuse to hear this, are more activists and more substantive due process than any liberal courts. They have overturned more laws enacted by Congress. That's their job, to overturn laws they don't like. And certainly Brett Kavanaugh is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
This is the activist judiciary that the conservatives rail against. But that's right. Exactly what they want when it's in their favor.
Yep, I absolutely agree, Paul. And if you can find out if this particular court in any one year or throughout the existence, you know, since John Roberts has been Chief Justice, has handed down more 5-4 decisions than any other court in history, I'd love to know that. I'm writing a book on the Supreme Court right now.
So, I know that, and I would look at, you know, look at the court through from the Lochner era through FDR through 1936,
right.
And you will see that there was that, and probably the courts during the during after Reconstruction, that was another period they
yep.
overturned acts by. I mean, look at in 1918. This is 100 years ago. In 1918, Congress outlawed child labor under the Commerce Clause, under the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Right.
And in Hammer versus Dagenham.
And the court overturned it.
And overturned it, saying that this was William Rufus Day wrote the decision, if Congress were to outlaw child labor, they might outlaw all labor.
Right, because it was based on the right to contract.
Yeah, exactly, because people have a right to take the crappiest job available.
Right, exactly, even if they're 12 years old. Well said,
Paul. 4 years old. I mean, they had kids working, 4 and 5 years old, were working in mills, mines, and factories, getting their hands and fingers chopped off. They had kids working in match factories, were getting sulfur corrosion in their nose and their nasal cavities. And they said, no, this is perfectly okay. And Congress can't do anything about it under the Commerce Clause because the Commerce Clause does not extend to protecting workers.
Right.
That was in Hammer versus Dagenhart. Well, 100 years ago, and that's what we're back to. Brett Kavanaugh is a perfect fit for, you know, anywhere from about 1870 to, 1936. And you look at the decisions that were overturned, you know, when we had the Four Horsemen, when you had George Sutherland, Willis Van Devanter, Pierce Butler, and the most slimeball of all, James Clark McReynolds. Those guys were big overturners of laws of Congress.
Oh yeah. So that 1918 case.
I mean, everybody knows the switch in time. That was Owen J. Roberts who came over to Roosevelt's side after supposedly the court packing scheme threat. But I don't think that's why Roberts. Switched over, but
I think he
those
switched.
Are conservative courts.
Yeah, I think he switched.
Down duly passed laws of Congress.
Yeah, and that was Daggett v. who?
1918, the child labor law was Hammer versus Dagenhart.
Hammer, thank you.
Hammer versus Dagenhart, 1918. That's part of the Lochner era.
Yeah. Amazing stuff, Paul. Amazing stuff. I got to move along, but thank you for the call, Paul. It's great to hear from you.
I'll send along whatever I find out, Tom.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Good talking with you. Christian in Germany. Hey, Christian, thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
Hello, Tom. I just have an idea because I follow the progressive discussion in the U.S. thoroughly sorry, I'm not a native speaker, so I just...
Oh, your English is great. It's so much better than my Deutsch.
not the general election, but the other, the before, how do you call it?
Midterm elections?
Pardon?
The midterm elections?
Not the midterm elections, but the elections for the party. Sorry,
oh, the primary elections.
I just messed it up.
Yeah, no, that's good. They're called primary elections.
It's a primary. Sorry, I forgot it.
It's quite right.
Tom, I don't know if you have the ability to, right now, as we're talking, to search at Wikipedia the term social market economy. That's the German system.
Mm-hmm.
German right-wing politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Konrad Adenauer, Ludwig Erhard, first chancellor and first minister of economic of the Federal Republic of Germany.
Sure.
Invented after Second World War, including universal healthcare, a unemployment insurance in system which gives us Germans the safety. You don't starve to death if you got unemployed,
yep.
And you even have a modest, not so much, but a financial safety net for a certain period of time.
Right.
And the government or government agency in support you by finding new jobs.
Yep.
Sometimes the service is mediocre, but that's all over the board. And this system is called social market economy, or has another name, which might be more comfortable for the U.S. System of thinking, Rhine capitalism, after the River Rhine, because the then capital was at Bonn, at the River Rhine.
Yeah.
Rhine capitalism.
We call it democratic socialism here, what you guys have there in Germany, and you know, we would like it. Christian, thanks so much for the call. I'm sorry we're hitting the break here. So I've got to bail out, but thank you for watching us on YouTube, and thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. It's nice to hear a German accent. We'll be back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. 12 minutes before the hour. Excuse me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls in just a moment. Stick around. And welcome back. Laura in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Laura, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I would like to bring up an issue that I haven't heard much at all being talked about. You know, there are so many barriers to voting that have been created that even if a person successfully gets to the voting booth, their vote may have been changed on a rigged voting machine, or they've been given a provisional ballot so their vote wasn't counted. And if you remember in the 2016 election, there were long lines of people all over the country waiting to vote. And I believe that there were more people voting Democrats than were recorded. And so I don't think that there was a shortage of people voting Democrats.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton got...
I believe that the votes weren't counted.
I think you're probably right. I think that a lot of people got provisional ballots, particularly in these red states or the states that are controlled by Republicans, like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and because they've been purged from the voting rolls, number one. Number two, it's entirely possible the machines were hacked, whether they were hacked by Russians or Republicans, who knows, but you know, it's entirely possible. If the Russians could do it, the Republicans could do it, or the Chinese could do it, as Donald Trump said yesterday or day before yesterday. I mean, it's all possible, but and it shouldn't be. None of it should be possible. And I think you're right, Laura.
Well, yeah, so when we tell Democrats to get out and vote, and they're up against the same barriers.
Well, here's the lesson for us, Laura. If they're going to steal the election by 5 million votes, we need to turn out 7 million extra people. You know, unfortunately, it's not enough to simply, you know, do business as usual. I mean, if you look at, like, you know, gerrymandering, Pennsylvania sent 13 Republicans and 7 Democrats to Congress. But there were more votes for Democratic members of the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania than what there were for Republicans. I mean, it should have been the opposite. And this is because of gerrymandering in that case. Now, you know, so you combine all these things. You get the gerrymandering, you get the vote suppression, you get the caging, you get and this is how the Republicans have been able to seize and hold power. And hopefully they're not going to be able to do it very much longer. I think Donald Trump is wrecking the Republican Party. This is why people like Rick Wilson, who was a guest on our program in the second hour, are coming out now and saying, well, his new book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, are saying what they're saying. And from his lips to God's ears, I mean, you know, may Donald Trump end up leaving the presidency. I mean, we'll see. But you know, the fact that the White House is in lockdown right now, if these reports are accurate, and that we're not seeing Sarah Huckabee Sanders on TV because nobody's going to go before the cameras right now after Donald Trump just confessed that his son committed a felony. And, oh, by the way, I didn't know anything about it. This has got to have blown the minds of people in the White House, just completely blown their minds. And I'm wondering if Mike Pence is sitting down with Donald Trump right now negotiating, Donald, if you resign, I will pardon you. And you don't even have to say that you're resigning because of these terrible things you've done and said. You can simply say your business needs you and you want to get back to making money. And you're sick and tired of the fake news or something like that. But we'll see. I mean, we'll know probably by the end of the day. But Laura, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. It is coming up on 53 minutes, past the hour, about 7 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll be right back. It is 53 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Denise in Tabamash, Colorado. Am I saying that right, Denise? I suspect I'm not. Denise? Denise, you need to be listening to your telephone, not your, but, you know, I'm going to unlock the lines here. Give us a call back if you want to try it again, because you were calling about Buddhism, a topic that is close to my heart. Tim in Vermont. Hey, Tim, thanks for watching us. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate what you do. I'm just kind of puzzled here with what's going on in the White House, and I try to be as optimistic as possible. When I say the White House, with what's happening with Trump and the vote and all that,
yeah,
and now all these the decision in the Ohio Supreme Court, I'm kind of lost on where the votes, where are the laws, too many loopholes, who's being held accountable.
Yeah, basically nobody's being held accountable except voters, right? You know, it's like, and the Republicans in these southern states, if they find a black person who has voted illegally because they're an ex-felon or because they're registered in another state or whatever, they are arresting them and hitting them with multiple years of prison. I mean, you know, they're just like gung-ho. Anyhow, Tim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll see how it plays out. Nick,
hey.
In New York, listening to SiriusXM, says here you want to tell me I'm wrong.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you always paint Europeans as these evil individuals that were more evil than any other human beings. And I'm sorry, you know, that is racism in and of itself. In the Native Americans, you know, you can't just say Native Americans. They were individual tribes that had their own cultures, their own way of life. And you know what? When the Lakota was thrown out of where the Chippewa Nation was, they overcame the Lakota. Lakota came over to the modern-day Dakotas. Lakota and Dakota are about the same thing. And when the Cheyenne saw them on the plains, they knew they weren't Plains Indians. They taught them how to live off the land. They took them in. And once the Lakota got proficient enough to live off those lands, they nearly destroyed them. They nearly killed them off. Ask the Hopi about the Apache.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the Hopi-Apache wars. What you're talking
about... No, I'm just saying, it's ridiculous how it's only
Nick,
Europeans
point made.
Wanted to kill
Nick,
every person.
Stop for a second. You made your point, and I agree with you. But you understand the history of why the Plains Indians came down, the Dene people. These were the people from southern Canada, why they came down into the central part of what we now call the United States.
Yes, and what I'm saying is
800-900 years ago, there was a major climate change event. These people were fleeing famine, and yeah, there was war that broke out, but that was not something that
the Chippewas overtook the Lakotas from where modern day Minnesota is, and they threw them out and they left their land. And when they came across the plains, the Cheyenne took them. And they nearly got wiped out by them.
Yep. Got it, Nick. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. What a day. What a day. I think the crazier Donald Trump is, the crazier we all get, right? But Nick is right. I was hyper-generalizing, but broadly speaking, I refer you again to Peter Farb, one of the great anthropologists in the history of the United States, who'd studied first contact with Native American tribes over 34 different tribes across the United States. And did not find genocidal warfare, with the exceptions of people who are being pushed around by climate change. Anyhow, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.